She goes so prompt, early. Hi, it's Bill.
Hi, Bill. It's Eric Clapton.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Good, good. Thanks so much for taking this time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was...
You know one another. We...
Well, I know...
We've done stuff before.
I know you, but no, I don't think we've ever... we've ever chatted.
Really? Okay. I thought we met. I thought your name seemed familiar to me, as if we were before.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've been in a band for, you know, a long time, but I don't know if you would have ever heard of us. And I've written a couple of Stones books, but we've never chatted.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, here we go.
How have you been?
I've been all right, thank you.
Yeah, you've been. Are you back in? You're back in the UK now, huh?
I've been here. Yeah, I live here really permanently. I have thought about moving over the last couple of years and try somewhere less restrictive. But it seems pretty global.
Hmm.
The pandemic. I'm sitting out here.
Yeah, you do. You do have a place down in Antigua still, yeah?
Yeah, and that would be a good place to go, but at the moment it's illegal.
Yeah.
To travel.
Right.
International travel for UK citizens anyway.
Oh, that's right.
But,
yeah.
That would be a good place. That's a pretty safe place to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, all right. Well, let's get into it. I've read your book, and I know the outlines of the history, but I guess you came to Leon via the Delaney and Bonnie record, right?
I think I had met or heard of Leon. I think at that point, just maybe because I'm not sure how close together it was, but he was doing, he was working with Joe Cocker, I think, around that time.
Right.
And also, I think he had been involved with their first album. So I had heard that. I had heard him play on In the Ghetto. So I knew what his thing was, you know, I heard him play.
Yeah, and... I was actually talking to Elton John, who credits you sort of with turning on a lot of the musicians back in England onto Leon and those guys.
Oh, well, that's nice.
glad
to be at service.
And had Alan Pariser sent you? I think I read in your book he sent you an acetate of that record. Is that right, the Delaney Bonnie?
Yeah. Through Cream, and I first met Alan when I went to LA with Cream, and we became buddies. And when Cream dissolved, and I was starting up Blind Faith with Steve Winwood, he knew we were coming to America. He asked if I would like to have Delaney and Bonnie, or we would like to have them open a show on our tour.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a fantastic idea. Little did I know how that would play out. But I should have known, really, because that was an incredible band. But I think he was, he managed them, I think, for quite a long time. And he was a very knowledgeable man in the music. He turned me on to the band, too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I owe Alan big time.
Yeah, Jimmy Carstein, I've been speaking a lot with him, and I know you guys were friends as well through that connection.
Yeah.
He remembers, he was telling me this story about how they played some showcase kind of show up in the Hollywood Hills, and you were in attendance with George Harrison. Does that ring any bells?
Where would that be? In Hollywood Hills? I'm not sure where that... What gig? I mean, if you told me the name of the gig, I might...
Well, I think it was at a house.
I'm here.
Yeah, it might have been Alan's house.
A house?
Yeah.
Well, it could have been not Leon's house. I don't remember. I'm not so sure. I mean, we weren't That would have been probably after I left Blind Faith. I actually joined Delaney and Bonnie, and we did a lot of touring around America.
Right, and so you
came back to Europe, yeah.
And so you.
I moved in with Delaney.
Yeah.
Sherman Oaks.
Yeah.
I mean, I became part of his family for quite a while. I met the Crickets. I met Leon. I met all kinds of people who lived over in Sherman. All the musicians from Tulsa lived over in Sherman Oaks. Most of them.
Yeah, at the plantation and nearby.
At the plantation, yeah, yeah.
And what do you remember of that scene was? I imagine it was a bit of culture shock moving in with Delaney and Bonnie, yeah?
Well, his mother, it was very odd because he lived with his mother and his wife and his kids. And I don't remember where I slept, and they must have had an extra room, I hope. But it was very, very, it was culture shock. It was a bit like the, Beverly Hillbillies, really.
Yeah.
Just straight out of Mississippi.
Yeah.
I think Delaney came from Mississippi. I'm pretty sure he did.
Yeah, I think so as well, yeah.
Yeah.
And, were you just kind of crashing there briefly, or how long were you there for, do you think?
I was loose. I didn't have anywhere else I wanted to be. I had... having left Cream and not really having settled down as a family man or a married man or anything, I was on the loose. I was in my ideal state.
Yeah.
Where was the next gig? That's all I wanted to know about. Who could I meet to play with? Even at that point, I didn't really even know, for instance, about J.J. Cale. I would still be. He was about two turnoffs down the motorway, and I didn't. I was like in a sweet shop, meeting all these musicians, and to actually know that I lived on the same street as Jerry Allison for me was I was in a dream. So these people all hung out every day, and they went and played clubs, and and I just suddenly. Felt really at home.
Yeah, yeah. And were you like sitting in down at the Palomino and Snoopy's Opera House and all
I
that?
I never did. I don't think I ever went to the Palomino. I think by the time I just hung around the house with I remember being in Sherman Oaks when it was kind of a down. Everyone was just hanging out, and we were making a record. We were making my first record, actually. That was what we were doing, and I remember we would drive to the studio in Delaney's Volkswagen, and he'd write half the songs on the way. That he would be writing the songs in the car. we didn't really have anything. It was the last minute.
Yeah. And that was at Village Recorders, or where was that?
Yes, I think it was at Village Recorders, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And you had started playing Strats somewhere in there, after Blind Faith or during that era?
Yeah, that's right. I think in Blind Faith I was playing either a Gibson 335 or a Telecaster. And I think I started playing Strat I can't remember when, went going through Nashville and finding a couple of old 57 Strats for virtually no money. And I thought this, and I had seen, different people that I admired were playing. I mean, Wingwood was playing one, I think. Steve Wingwood was playing one. Obviously, Buddy Guy and Jimmy.
Yeah.
And then Stevie Ray. But Stevie Ray came, it was just... It became the easiest guitar to play because it was so tough and it would stay in tune. And I love that sound. I was just getting into that mid pickup sound between the bridge and middle pickup.
Yeah, it's good. I was good.
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, you play, so 69, I think it was the late summer of 69 when Joe Cocker and Denny were up at Leon's place.
That's right.
Yeah.
Delta Lady.
Yeah, so Denny remembers you being there for Delta Lady. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, it seems like they were doing it in the bedroom or something. It was such a weird... That was Leon's house,
mm-hmm.
and it was the studio, and there was people getting stoned everywhere and lying on the bed. And at the same time, there's Joe singing Delta Lady. In the back, I'm like, what is happening? This is a movie. I'm in a movie. I mean, I loved everyone I met around that time. I thought they were all, this was, the real thing.
Yeah, and the reason I went back to that is because then that led to Denny coming over with Leon to do that record with Glenn Johns at Olympic. And, and you're on that, and that's where you're actually playing Strat, it sounds like, in the out of phase position on Prince of Peace. Do you remember that song?
Yeah. Leon, I think, had, I remember him coming to, when he came to England, he came to visit me. I don't know how he got, he must have got a driver or something. He came down to see me, where I live out in the country, and on his own. And he sat and he sang, this song, he sang Song for You, you know.
Mm.
And looking at me, it felt like, has he written this song? So, I mean, it was so personal. And I bet he got a real kick out of doing that. I'm sure he did that wherever he went, and sit down with the person that he wanted to sing it to and make it about them.
Mm.
It was a real thing. So he was a powerful man, a very powerful presence. And I was overwhelmed, and I was very, very young. I was very pleased. I was excited that he gave me that song to play on, because he knew I was having kind of Christian moments. Every 3 or 4 years, I'd had some kind of revelation or little weird coincidences would happen that would bring up my kind of childhood religious roots, you know, that being country boy, with, you know, going to Sunday school and going to church on Sundays, and that all would come up around me, you know, because and when I talked to Delaney about it, I said, he said, oh yeah, Leon's a preacher. Because in back here, you know, you don't say that unless someone is ordained. It's not something you say in a loose way. But then I came from working with Delaney during that period, and a couple of times with Leon, where he would come and play on stage with us. I saw that happen. I saw Delaney preaching. We were in the Fillmore and in San Francisco, and this weird dialogue started up between someone in the crowd who I think was having a bad trip, and he was shouting at Delaney, what about Hitler then? Did God make Hitler? And this kind of stuff was, Delaney seemed to bring this stuff out. they would come and see, just deliver, and he would get on the pulpit, you know, figuratively speaking, and we'd stand in watching and thinking, well, when are we going to do next number? Delaney would be on fire. And I'd heard too that Leon could do it. I didn't see him do it, but apparently he could do it too. You know, just lay preachers. They were lay preachers. And so when he sang that song to me, I just, it was unbelievable. What a great album. What a great idea. What a great album.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a huge fan of, I mean, she's an unbelievable player, unbelievable man.
Yeah, it's interesting. I discussed the preacher aspect with Bobby Whitlock, your bandmate there. And you know, his father actually was a preacher, so he talks about like Leon, yes, talked about Leon like peppering him with questions about the fire and brimstone stuff.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I remember there's actually a recording of that Fillmore West gig on the Bill Graham site, the Wolfgang's Vault site, and it's
always there.
Yeah, it's a really hot show. You guys are really on fire.
Yeah,
you can go to Wolfgang's Vault. But I was going to ask you, do you remember, were there just kind of a handful of gigs where Leon was actually playing as well?
I don't remember specifically. I remember that one because it was a memorable gig. And I don't know if it was that one, but it could have been that one. I do remember Leon playing. They did the Ghetto, and Leon played Hammond B3.
Oh.
And it was unbelievable. Unbelievable. Totally different thing. Because I had not heard him play Hammond or organ at all. And I didn't know that it was something he did. But it was a completely mind-blowing thing.
Yeah.
No, it didn't happen that often. He didn't come and guest that often. Maybe he didn't like traveling, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think he had his own thing going too, and he was just starting Shelter, And did you get to see any of the Mad Dog shows, or were you were elsewhere?
I think I was elsewhere. I think we were doing, I couldn't have been Derek and the Dominoes. I was definitely someone else. I can't tell what else was happening.
Yeah, so that would have been the spring.
Maybe it was pre that, you know.
Yeah, that was the spring of 70, and they came off that tour, Carl and Jim, and that's when, I guess, I think it was like during that time that Bobby Whitlock came out to your house, actually.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. That's right. He came out on his own, and we just hung out, yeah.
Right, yeah, and then, and so they finished the Mad Dogs tour, and then Carl and Jim came pretty much right over to your place, yeah?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And before we get into that, though, you had mentioned, I wanted to kind of talk about your record a little bit with all that. Basically, it's like, it's kind of the pre-Dominoes, and it's the Delaney and Bonnie Cats and all those guys and Leon on that record. Here's what I wanted to ask you. There seems to be a bit of vague mystery about who exactly brought you After Midnight. Was that Carl or Delaney that brought you the original J.J. Cale demo?
Well, you know, my recollection is that it was Delaney who actually had the single.
Okay.
Because there was another one that Delaney gave me, maybe it was before that, called I'm on the Outside Looking In. And on the B-side of that single was Slow Motion. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the predecessor single to After Midnight. So that might have been Delaney giving me that record, the On the Outside Looking In. And then I don't remember. If that was the case, I'm not sure who turned me on to After Midnight. My recollection, it's probably because I've simplified everything, is that it was solely Delaney who was talking to me. And it would make sense. Maybe I've made it that way because it would make sense because Delaney was really producing that album, and in a way it would fit that he would come up with that and say, well, you know, you're this. And then we just did it. You know, it was like it seemed to be. I think it was a very quick record to make. We did, as I said, when we didn't have a song, Delaney would write one in the evening of the day before, or he would write one in the car on the way to the studio, or he'd write one, like Leon would say, I got one, bet you didn't think, and that would be, he'd have two lines. The way it looked on the floor on that day, when we were just saying, well, what should we do? And he got, well, I don't know what to do. I got this song, you know, just... And Leon said that and said that. And I thought, oh, he's just thought this. He's just thought this up in his head. And it's with Benny here. And I thought, I've never seen anyone do that before. I've never in my life seen anyone actually start writing a song in the middle of this... You know, just say, what about this?
Yeah.
I mean, if it was me, I would go in a corner and think, I don't know, let me see if I can do this. And start practicing the idea, not just go.
Yeah.
And it was so, it was, we had it done in, I mean, the song is essentially, it's a pretty simple song. There's no middle eight or bridge or anything like that. It just, it is what it is, but we got it done very, very good. Maybe three or four takes, I think.
Yeah, there seems to be a bit of Leon type arranging where you guys got to kind of do that. It's not a middle eight per se, but it's what? It's that boom, bat, down, down, boom, and then it kind of.
Oh, yeah, it goes up. It actually does. It goes up a semitone.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
And it just for a sequence, yeah, a breakdown, a little bit, piano breakdown, yeah.
Yeah, and was he actually sort of. When it was he and Delaney in the same room together, was it, I imagine there was a bit of deference to Leon's arranging and production skills. Does that sound accurate?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I would say that from what I could see, everybody had something to say.
Okay.
Everybody. I mean, everybody in that room. Maybe with the exception of Bobby, because Bobby was... you know, a good deal younger than those guys, and was definitely just, I think Bobby was learning, as we all were, as I was anyway, that we were flying by it. But those guys seemed to be, and Carl, I include Carl with that, and Jim Price and Bobby and all the other guys all seemed to be on the same page. I never saw any kind of friction or any dominance. It would just seem to go back and forth. I mean, when Leon called that song, Delaney didn't, I mean, he just looked at me, he just followed it. And, and he, you know, I tell you what, it was one of the most loving environments I'd ever been in musically. There was, everyone was so kind of, there was not ever, I never saw any hint of jealousy or rivalry, those kind of things, which I had been around a lot, and maybe it was because I come from that kind of experience to what they were doing, that it felt like home, you know, it felt great for me.
That's a great way to remember it, and that's some great insight. Yeah, I guess that just made me, it made me think with that little bit of a twist in the middle there of Blues Power. You know, Leon had this way of taking something fairly traditional, like, for example, I'm kind of deep into Carney right now, and he's got the song My Cricket. Yeah. My Cricket is just like a 6/8 kind of soul thing, but he frames it with this like piano device. I don't know if it comes to your, comes to your memory, but it's an inventive little piece, you know, that distinguishes it. Yeah.
And, I know the song. I know that. I think Willie Nelson did it too.
That's right. Yeah, Willie. And
JJ did it too, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a great song. Great song.
Yeah, Jerry Lee Lewis even did a version. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I have a story that I should tell you that I forgot, always forget. I would have forgot if I don't say it now. That I remember when I was, after the Dominoes had broken up, and I was deep into hard drugs, not mainlining or injecting or anything, just snorting loads of smack. And everyone was worried, you know. I had gone off and shut the door. I wasn't letting anyone in. I spent about 2 to 3 years in isolation, really just throwing money at Chinatown, really. And at one point, George and Leon came over, and it must have been, I'm not sure whether he was there, I'm not sure of the chronology of that period, but he took me aside and said, "What are you doing?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, you know, this is pretty dark stuff. Why are you doing this?" And I was really moved. You know, I've never forgotten that. You know, it's one of those instances in my life where I felt like someone really, really cared.
Yeah.
And I knew George did anyway, but for Leon to come all this way, and there was even like a spark of curiosity in the question. And all I remember saying is, I don't know what I'm doing, but I know I've got to go through this for some reason to see, because maybe there's something to learn. I know I'm going to be all right, but I've got to go through it. But I don't know, I just thought, I wanted to tell you that because I don't want to ever leave that unsaid. And it was a big moment for me, for him to come and knock on my door. And no one, I haven't let anyone in for a long time.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. Yeah, go ahead.
And he gave me, on that visit, he gave me a book written by Stanislavski, The Actor Prepared. It's cool. He was a big fan of Stanislavski.
Huh. I had not heard that. Which is cool because, you know, I've been asking his family and people at various points in his life what he was into. You know, for example, Carney really has this Fellini-esque kind of thing. And I said, was he watching Fellini with blah, blah, blah? So books, all that kind of stuff is really great for me to flesh out his personality at that time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's in your book. Not the part about Stanislavski, though, about him coming by, and that would have been...
Oh,
I think it's somewhere...
Yeah, oh, I'm glad, because I sometimes forget what I've said and where I've said it, whether I've said it. Yeah, it was a deep moment, you know.
Yeah, I think that was prior to coming out for Bangladesh, at least in your book.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And well, let's talk about that then. Let's talk about Bangladesh. So I know the backstory from the DVD extras, and you're interviewed on that as well. But you missed a few flights getting out there, and you weren't sure if you were actually going to get there. Or?
I just didn't want to go. I didn't want to go because I knew I'd be stretched, you know. There would be a period of I'd go through cold turkey,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't sure if I could handle it. I mean, I've been, you know, an addict that's got to go through that, you know. Invariably, you're going to go through cold turkey if you've got that kind of habit. But I knew if I got on a plane, I knew before even I would land in. In America, I'd already begun into withdrawals, and it's, you know, having done it many times by then, I really didn't want to see. I didn't see if it was feasible to be able to play or show up to rehearsals and then do my best. I knew I was. It was going to be. But then, you know, the people at the other end up from. George's office or people in the production company were saying, "Oh, we can take care of that when you get there. There'll be someone there with some stuff for you to get straight on, you know." And there wasn't. It didn't, you know, it didn't materialize, and I didn't make it to. So I did. I did. I mean, I wanted to go, but I knew it would be catastrophic, and it. In a way, it was, and I've never really been able to equate that with what I would normally want to do. I mean, just you know, it was one of those times when I dropped the ball really badly, and I remember showing up for rehearsals on the third day or something, and someone had gotten me some kind of painkiller, which I think it came from.
Alan Klein.
Yeah,
I think you said
Alan Klein.
Yeah,
Alan Klein had some some that were built for his stomach, for his ulcers or something like that. And I remember seeing everybody in the dressing rooms, in the locker rooms at the Garden, and Bob and Leon and Jesse and everyone that was playing, and I just thought, I can barely talk. I can barely make conversation, and these are all these luminaries, you know, people that I look up to or I could even consider to be colleagues. And I felt so out of it. And just thought, you shouldn't have come here. And I remember making the gig and being there. Don't remember much about it in terms of recollection, but remember watching the film when it came out and thinking, you weren't there, actually. You really weren't there. I don't know who you think you were on there. I think George was, I did it for George, you know, really, and I did it for Ravi. And I had become friends with Bradley, and I really respected him. And I thought, well, I've got to show up for this, no matter how it feels. And maybe it wasn't the best thing to do. The worst thing, it could have been worse. I could have fallen down.
Well,
you never know. I mean, I got by, but.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, you know, Eric Clapton at half speed or whatever, at half ability, still, you know, your star power and your playing. The only part that seems a bit discordant is when you, as you note, you pick up the hollow body for some reason, or the semi-hollow, and you're trying to get the sustain, yeah. The sustain on while my guitar gently weeps.
Yeah. Well, I got that guitar right here, and I don't have a problem with it sustaining. I don't know what happened. I mean, those things, that would have happened, you know, even if I'd been fully compass mentors, you can never tell when it would. But, yeah, I know, it was a bit of a mishmash, I'm glad to be in service.
You know, I was talking to Jim Keltner, and he says that... he really points to Jesse Ed during that show as somebody that sort of helped kind of keep the glue of all these different players together. And he couldn't quite finger it, but I think it was just he had maybe zoned in to Jesse that night and really played with him quite tightly.
That's a great observation, because Jesse didn't get, in my view, he didn't get the accolades he deserved. I mean, people should have known more about him at the time. You know, for myself, I remember meeting him with Taj at the Rolling Stones circus.
Oh, yeah.
That thing. And I'd already heard Giant Steps. I knew what was going on with Jesse Ed, and I thought, oh man, and he really is a Native American as well. I mean, what an incredible guy.
Yeah.
And we had to spend a lot of time together then, and we made a record and in London at Olympic, and yeah, I mean, he was a big hero, and I spent some more time with him later on in LA. Great player.
Yeah. And what about, you know, I've been talking a bit to Don Preston, who said to say hey, and that he's still...
Oh, yes.
He said he's still using 011s, but he's had to start lifting weights, he said.
Yeah, that's the first time I saw Don was with Leon, too.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, just... From your guitar player perspective, for me, you know, I grew up listening to you and Mick Taylor and the Blues Breakers and that kind of stuff, and I didn't really know who Don Preston was until I was born in '66, so I'm only 54, but I came into Mad Dogs and Englishmen, and I didn't really know much more than that at that time, but as a guitar player, but now listening to Don Preston, I'm like, this guy. He was almost like you and Peter Green. He had this sort of tone that was...
But not
many people know about him.
I know. It's a crying shame, man. The amount, I mean, I felt like that's been my mission all through my life, is to say, well, don't you know about these? And something, you know, be like Triplehorn. I had never heard of Tommy Triplehorn until I actually went to Tulsa. Mm. And then, you know, and I would talk to Carl. Carl told me about Tommy Triplehorn. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why doesn't he? And he said, because he doesn't like leaving town.
Yeah.
He doesn't really care whether people know about him or not. And I just thought it was my duty to go home and tell everyone. I don't know if I ever really made me do it. But, you know, that was, I loved that. I mean, especially getting to know JJ and the way he liked to live his life, because he didn't want anyone to know.
Mm-hmm.
He liked it the way it was, so he could have a quiet life. But
mm-hmm.
I found out everywhere I went in America that unlike anywhere else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like
that there would be a guitar player, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and you have done that. You've brought this attention to people via Crossroads festivals, and I mean, most of those people are.
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, just that's an aside. I mean, I didn't know John Mayer as a guitar player until I saw him wailing something on one of your festivals, and I'm like, geez, this guy can play, you know.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about Carl. He's sort of the mystery man here. I mean. Jimmy Carstein said a lot about him. He's like, you know, he was the guy that always had his shoes polished and got up on time and was the responsible guy until he no longer was, until he fell into drugs or whatever else. But was he pretty clean at the time of the Dominoes, or is that when he started to slide into stuff?
I think when I first met Carl with Delaney and everybody would say we all like to drink and we all like to do a little bit of weed and then a little bit of coke and then a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it seemed to be that we were moving through a time when stuff was becoming available and people were turning you on. You know, I remember one party we had that Leon threw, I think, a birthday party at Sunset Sound. There was a very a famous lady from Tulsa who was not Emily, but someone else, who liked to look after you when you were on a gig, and we come and bring something for you or something. She was handing out. We all took TCP, I think, for the first time, and what I'm trying to say is that it was all uncharted territory.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone was like, well, try some of this, try some of that. And I don't, you know, I don't remember anyone being more adept than anyone else. You know, Carl was just... hey, I'll go with the flow. I mean, that was the thing I got from Carl. That was, why not? Let's. We're having too much. We're not having too much fun. We're just having too much fun. I mean, he wasn't a party animal, but he would. He saw the sense in it.
Yeah.
Rather than have to leave, I can't be around it, so I got to leave. Or having to be the one we all have to carry out. No. There wasn't anyone like that at that period in time. It wasn't. I mean, Carl's disappearance, I don't know anything about it, because I had already was in so much trouble with booze that I had to quit the band while Carl was in it, you know, and Albert Lee, and I had Jamie, I think, and Dickie.
Mm-hmm.
And Carl, and we were just—it was lethal what we were doing to one another. And I think they were the American guys were going one way, and me and Albert were going the other. And it was alcohol for the English guys, and drugs for the Oakies. And I didn't even know about Carl's, you know, the depth of his problem until it was too late.
Yeah, I mean, people say that a lot of his friends say the same thing, and guys like Jimmy Karstein that knew him all the way back were sort of surprised, I think, because, like he said,
yeah,
he wasn't even smoking pot in the Gary Lewis and the Playboys days when the other guys were. He was the guy that was looking out for them, you know, because they wanted to keep him from getting fired or whatever. But so it kind of took them by surprise as well.
Well, speaking for myself, I never saw myself as an addict or an alcoholic, but I am.
Right.
And I don't know where that came from. And it could even be that it came on Carl late, you know, because like you said about Jimmy saying he was the guy that was always on time, shining shoes. And I never saw Carl as being that self-disciplined, but He did show up, and he was actually the root of any band that we were in together. He was the driving force, and he was the guy that was most conscientious about are we doing this properly?
Mm-hmm.
Is everyone paying attention? Kind of thing. He didn't like it if people were just goofing off, as they say. But at the same time, I could see him, how he liked to get stoned like the rest of us.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe the art that I love saw him, maybe that just accelerated, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm sorry about...
It is.
I was going to say, I'm sorry about Jamie Oldecker's passing was fairly recent too, huh?
Yeah,
now,
you know, and unfortunately with Carl, we never had the chance to say goodbye. I mean, maybe it's just the times are changing now. The people that I've said goodbye to, we've actually gone out of our way to arrange that. Well, either a family member has called and said, you know, would you, this is the time. This is the time now to say something to one another. For Jamie and Dickie, I had that opportunity. And I'm really grateful. I'm really sad that I never got a chance to talk to Carl before he left. I wish they were all still here, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lonely world for musicians of my age now that, you know, a lot of my partners are gone.
Yeah. Yeah, and I imagine you count yourself extremely fortunate given all the boundaries you've pushed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how I got away with it.
Well, it's all the more reason to keep creating because you've got the responsibility too, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. There's somewhere, you know, I read in the liner notes of this greatest hits thing that Leon had. It's a little unreliable because I know that there's some errors in there as well. But it refers to Leon having a quote unquote sort of nervous breakdown while working with Eric Clapton in England. The combined stresses simply became too much, and he suffered a nervous breakdown. And this would have been in the early '70s somewhere. Does that sound anything? Does that ring any bells or anything?
No, I don't remember. I mean, there were very during that time when he was in England, I didn't see him that much.
No,
I don't remember anything specific like that.
Yeah,
I don't remember hearing anything nature at all happening inside. I mean, maybe it did, but I don't know. Nothing that I observed. No.
Do you remember sort of later collaborations? There was something where you, I think, went to the lake house up in Grand Lake, Leon's lake house, in 74. It's actually...
What was that? I think I just went up there to hang out. I don't think we did anything.
Yeah, there was something.
I don't think we did anything.
There's some.
I played on something.
Well, I think it's just your own. I don't think it was ever released. I think it was just sort of a loose sort of jam thing. And it's referred to in a sessions book of that somebody put out of your sessions. But there's also, I've heard a recording. Well, there's a sort of a famous-ish bootleg on YouTube of, it's called Eric Clapton and Leon Russell Apartment Jam, quote unquote. It's just, I think it's Mary Russell was there at the time, and,
Mary McCrary?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I think it must have been that same thing for up at the lake.
And I don't remember what we did. I remember going to visit him.
Yeah.
There. And he, if anything, he was pretty detached, and I don't know if there was anything going on. It just didn't seem to be. He was going through a period, I think, where he had a panel of TV screens. You know how you see in a science fiction movie.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a thing. I think it was something you had to have at some point then, back like a Hugh Hefner type thing, where one wall had to be TV screens with every channel. Each one had a different channel. I think he actually had that in the studio, and I remember this coming back to me now, just thinking, where's he, what is happening with Leon? Leon's gone completely out of my door, I don't know, and, but I don't remember what we did music, but you know the thing that I've often, while we're talking here, I never ever could find the Motel Shop album.
Oh.
There was an album.
Yeah.
Do you know about this?
Yeah, yeah. It's been reissued. It's been reissued. In fact, I have a friend who wrote the liner notes for it, for the reissue.
Can you get it on iTunes? Or how do you get it?
Yeah, yeah. It's on. I don't know if you use Spotify or anything like that, but it's on iTunes.
Oh,
yeah.
My kids do. Yeah. Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah.
I remember when that was happening. It was such a unique. And they were doing it on those little, I think they were using those little Sony portable Walkman outfits with two speakers in a briefcase. You know?
Yeah.
I remember that happening and thinking, my God, this is such a great idea. What a great idea.
And when you were remembering it, was it actually going on the road or was it sort of after the fact?
It was going on the road, yeah. It was going on because we all had that outfit. It was the kind of the thing everyone had to have, you know, with this sort of soft leatherette case that it came in, two speakers and a tape machine, a cassette machine with a microphone, and man, it was first rate recording quality, you know.
Yeah, that's great because I think they took that idea, and I don't think that the Motel Shot kept any of the actual motel recordings. I think they recreated that sort of loose scene. Yeah, they did it up at Bruce.
That was, yeah. You know, the thing was, because I remember hearing this stuff on the cassettes. I remember hearing the cassettes, and that may have been part of what made it so fantastic was that, you know, there's those condenser mics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Condenser mics that we sometimes built into the Walkman. They had the sound man that would, so you'd have this whole band singing into one mic, one little condenser mic, and that may be, so I'm going to check this out to see if it.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. It would have this almost fantastic compression to it and this brilliance.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's like what Keith did on Street Fighting Man and Jumpin' Jack Flash.
Street Fighting Man is untouchable. Yeah. Untouchable.
Yeah, that acoustic kind of slash electric sound, yeah. Yeah, I talked to Dave Mason, who was also on that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah, so what they did was I think Alan Pariser said, well, this is all a good idea, but let's do this in a proper studio. I think they started up at Bruce Botnick's house and they did it mostly there. And then I think they did some actual studio work. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, you should listen to it. There's some great stuff on it for sure. And Leon's playing is killer.
Yeah.
Cause in the motel, they wouldn't have had the piano, but so here they, they actually gather around a big old piano.
Yeah, it would have been all Delaney and Bobby probably on acoustic, and Dave acoustic.
Yeah, so you kept in touch with Leon at least into the mid-70s or so? Did it kind of fall apart or dissipate or go your own ways after that, or did you stay in touch?
We didn't really stay in touch. I can't remember the last time I saw him,
yeah,
to be honest. I think I went to see him in a roadhouse just off PCH at one time, and he played his whole set at breakneck speed, like he couldn't wait to get off.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of people say the same thing. Yeah.
And, I don't know. I mean, the good times. It's probably, I don't know how he was in the later days. I really don't. What it was like being around him all the time.
And
the kind of music he was making, I lost touch.
Yeah, he went down a... I think he just started shooting himself in the foot with bad decisions, starting around 74, and never really came back to his peak, you know, and he started doing a lot of stuff on his own with just sort of bad MIDI sounds. I mean, everybody fell prey to bad digital sounds in the 80s, but he kind
of
went...
I think that was part of that thing where I went to see him, where I told you I saw he had all the... he was doing everything that... You know, when that does happen, that isolation thing where you think, well, I'm just going to start, put a drum track down, then I'll add a bass, then I'll put some keyboard and guitar, then I'll put a voice on anything. I mean, I know myself, if I don't do that, I don't have the technical ability or interest, but I know enough to know that it's like a mouse hole, you know, you go down and I would lose all sense of perspective so quick. I know. I wouldn't even try.
Yeah.
You know, one of the greatest things I saw Leon do was with the Bluegrass.
Yeah, Newgrass Revival.
And I think that album, that version of Wild Horses is unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
That version of Wild Horses, man. Oh.
Yeah, and they do it. He had written a song on Americana, the album called Americana, which was produced with Kim Fowley, and it was a weird record.
I remember Kim Fowley.
I bet you do. Character, huh?
Oh, man. He was at the beginning. It's like he invented all this stuff that we're...
Alley-oop.
Now,
Yeah, and then he was like, I mean, what a only in California, right? I mean, then he discovered the Runaways, the teenage with Joan Jett, and remember them,
yeah.
Sherry O'Terry and
Lita
Ford, yeah, Cherry Bomb. Anyway, there's a song on that record called. One More Love Song, I think it's called. For some reason, I'm drawing a blank. But
yeah, it's going to sing you One More Love Song.
Sing you One More Love Song.
That's on that.
On the Newgrass record. And that's a great version on the Newgrass record.
It's the fantastic version.
It's
the keyboard sound that he's got. And just the accompaniment. It's a perfect setting for him. That
yeah.
He should have stuck with that a little longer. It was a one-off.
Yeah, I think
I saw him play. I saw him do it live in either in LA or Tulsa. I think could have been Tulsa.
Yeah, I think he did.
I saw it live. That was a great show.
They recorded a record there at the Pasadena Playhouse or Perkins Palace.
That was it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That CP70. He's playing that electric piano. The Yamaha.
Yeah.
Baby Grand. Yeah, you're right. I mean, and he did that for a couple of years. They kind of didn't, the band almost sort of broke up because they didn't want to stay on the road as much as he did. But he was really into it.
Oh, really? Well, that's good news. I'm glad it went somewhere.
Yeah, it was good. That was a good comeback. So tell me, you know, just from your standpoint as a player and a collaborator, what can you tell me about how you felt about his piano playing and his whole shtick, you know, his strengths, I guess.
Well, I'm a kind of blues and gospel piano musician. What's the word? Aficionado.
Yeah.
My favorite group to begin with was a player called Big Maceo Merriweather, and he played with a guy called Tamp Red, and they made a load of records back in the 40s. And so he was, I think he was the guy that Ray Charles listened to a lot, and Charles Brown, and that was his fan. So I was almost would have rather have been a piano player than a guitar player, but we didn't have a piano. I couldn't get, you know, we didn't have room for a piano where I was brought up. And so I kind of, by the time I heard Leon, I was already, you know, Little Richard and Ray Charles and Huey Lewis and all those people from New Orleans and, you know, but I was deep into it. I wanted to hear anything like that. And so if I was, you know, the chance of being around someone who was still kind of young and able and that I could play with was incredible. You know, he was a church player, gospel player, and a blues player as well. And I, you know, just to be around musicians like that when they're so unique and rare to have that opportunity to play with someone. I mean, he was a giant.
Yeah.
He was a giant.
Yeah.
And effortless, you know. The first time he approached, it was like Billy. Him and Billy, for me, were very similar in that you could, they could walk up to a song, sit down and start playing it, and you wouldn't be able to improve on anything they did first time around. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and what a treat to have them both on the stage at Bangladesh.
Oh, yeah.
That version, I mean, it was, there were a couple of, I mean, Leon's moment there was great, but I mean, Billy's doing, That's the Way God Planned It, and getting out on the proscenium of the stage and dancing was just fantastic.
Yeah.
It never fails to bring a smile. So you played with some great piano players, Dickie, right, was the piano player.
Yeah.
Chris Stanton, also a great player, right?
Chris is still, we work often. Whenever I go out, I take Chris because he's my—he's like my security blanket. I know I'm going to be all right if he's there.
Yeah.
And he doesn't age. He's amazing. he's got to be in his coming up to 80 or something, and he looks like he's 30.
I had no idea he was on I had no idea he was on the older side of you guys.
Yeah, no, he's got to be about 70, I'm 76, he's probably about 78, I think.
Jeez, I talked to him as well, he was hard to track down, but I got him, and he was delightful to talk to, especially about Leon. He was, really held him in high esteem.
Did you
do some stuff with Nicky Hopkins as well, I assume, at some point?
Oh, very good. No, nothing really. I don't think I ever did play with Nicky on a session. We were around at the same time all this stuff was being born in London. You know, the Stones and me and John Mayall and the Yardbirds and Richard. Nicky was on all the sessions then. He was, and he was actually, I think he was in Screaming Lord Sutch's band at one point, which was another birth place for great musicians. You know, a lot of great players came out of Screaming Lord Sutch's band. But no, I never did. I never had that chance. But you know, the thing about Leon that also Delaney told me, I always forget, that is that, you know, from the polio thing, that he had, Delaney would say, look, watch it, because if he starts to get tired, he'll use the other hand to hold the hand he's playing with. And I don't know if that was, I don't, I never saw him do it, but
he would literally.
But I thought that was extraordinary, wouldn't you? Because you would never know that, would you? When you saw it play, you would never know that there had been any kind until you saw him walk.
He would. Delaney was saying he would literally just take the other hand in one and hold the.
Yeah.
Hold
the other hand. Hold the right. Say if it was the right hand that was doing a lot of like a roll or something. Delaney said, and this is the one. This is Delaney said this. The paint said that. But I never saw it. Doesn't mean to say it didn't happen. But he said he would sometimes take his left hand and hold the right hand by the wrist.
Mm. It makes sense because the right hand is he was naturally that's the side that the birth injury happened. He had this. It wasn't I think people would start.
It wasn't polio.
Right. It was like a cerebral sort of brain. It was like a vertebrae injury. But I think he let people think it was polio because you know it's easier than explaining it all, I guess. But
easier. Cool.
But that was his. It was on the right side, and he was naturally left-handed. I think as a person who was born left-handed anyway. So the right hand was weak. So that would make sense if he did that from time to time, if it got fatigued or whatever.
Yeah. Well, listen, Bill. I gotta head out. So.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time. I guess if I could just ask, one last question. Did he accuse you, quote unquote, of stealing his band when Marcy joined and all those guys? Do you remember that?
Oh, for crying out loud! This goes on all this. Oh, well, it's time for me to set the record straight. This wasn't even my idea. It wasn't my idea. I was so stoned at that point in time. I don't think I knew. A couple of tracks that she was on, I didn't play on half that album. I was so out.
Yeah.
I think we were in Jamaica. We were in Jamaica doing an album. She came down, and I relinquished all responsibility. This was something to do the Tulsa team.
Yeah.
I think it would have been Carl and Dickie, probably.
Yeah.
Carl and Dickie up to no good. Those two.
And
I take no.
And were you just kind of visiting Tulsa from time to time, or did you actually spend a good amount of time there?
I only went once to stay with Carl for about a month.
Okay.
When we were in the Dominoes, I think, later on when we were touring.
Yeah.
I went up there with my first wife, and we stayed in Claremont. I think it was basically Claremont.
Right.
And,
right.
And I saw the Gap Band when they were young, saw Tommy Triplehorn, and I saw met all kinds of crazy people, and had a great time.
You got the whole Tulsa experience.
I know that. I would quite like that. That old legend, the idea, because Delaney was the same. With Delaney, I got it in the neck for Delaney that I've stole his band. I mean, these guys came knocking at my door.
Yeah, exactly. Literally. All right. Well, thank you so much for all your time, Eric. It's been an honor to chat with you and to take all this time.
Glad to have been of service.
All right, man. Take care.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.